Settle down.
Well,
hello. This evening we're going to apply what you and I have discussed on the phone this week about studying. So we're going to get more involved, and if they don't get involved, you and I will get more involved like we do when we talk on the phone, just us.
Okay.
And try to show, so everyone else can kind of see what goes on a little bit.
That would be nice.
That would be nice. Okay, so you're on, and it's yours.
Okay. Okay, so getting back to the Kashrus, I will answer the question about that we raised last week about the Ben Noach and taking a day off. But I would prefer, if we can, just at this point, to continue with the kashrus and finish that, then we'll return. Now, the main concept, to put it in, I was talking with David over the phone this week, and it helped me, you know, crystallize the main idea that we've been saying, and that is that the kashrus has nothing to do with the emotion of the taboo. Now, taboo is a very primitive emotion. And we have to realize that these emotions exist in all of us, even in modern man. As a matter of fact, psychoanalysts show how the human unconscious is really primitive in nature, and it explains many of our dreams based upon the primitive and, the primitive religions, the primitive element in man. Now, the Torah raises man above the primitive, and when we say that the entire Torah is against idolatry, what we mean essentially is not just the formal idolatry, but it's against the primitive part of man. Taboo is a very primitive emotion. And as I explained last week, the two reasons for kashrus, one is to, as the Torah says, to differentiate, to raise man to the higher intellectual sphere. That's one purpose. That's the positive commandment. And also to prevent man from eating those things which primitive tribes would eat just because they had certain qualities like spiders, like weird things that are despicable to man. Now, the reason why these things are despicable to man is because, and this is a matter of, again, it's a psychoanalytical concept, but to my mind it's 100% in line with the Torah. These things are despicable to man because they represent certain repressed wishes of man, infantile. And the primitive man thinks that there's some mystical benefit in eating some of these, what we would call, I guess, weird kind of things. And the Torah is against that concept, that man should believe that eating some of these things will give him some kind of powers or mystical, has some mystical value. And that was the second part, which we mentioned last week, where the Torah emphasizes to keep away from the creeping things which have that kind of a quality to it. Usually those creeping things are precisely what the primitive people are attracted to and make rites out of these things. So that was the idea we mentioned last week. Two concepts. But there is no concept of an animal being taboo, something wrong with the animal. And I'm going to get back to that in just one moment. I just want to introduce a third concept as well. And there's a third reason for kashrus. And this reason has been one which is extremely important. We find in there is a law in the Torah, and it is in it's in Bamidbar. That's Numbers. Pacey, you can give me Chumash Bamidbar. Excuse me. And the law states over there that anything which when they conquered the Midianites, so there was a special command given. You may remember to take the vessels of the Midianites and to purify them. And this is mentioned in the Torah, where it says it is in Numbers 31:23. Anything which comes in fire, you should put in fire, and you should cleanse. Okay, and that verse actually is where koshering things come from. That which is, for instance, a pot which is used over the fire. The way you kosher it is the same way as it's used over the fire, and things that are used, the way the thing is used, that's the way you kosher it. Now, the reason for this prohibition, this Torah prohibition against using the vessels that the Midianites use, and it's not just the Midianites, but for a Jew, it's the vessels of the Gentiles. And the reason for that is, when one studies the Torah and the oral law about that, is again to keep the people away from the food of the idolaters, that there should be a distance in the people's mind between the idolaters and their food. And there's another place which has a similar concept. and that is in Exodus. In Exodus, we find that the Torah states that there'd be great danger, and that's really after the story of the golden calf. That's Exodus 34, 15, where it says, "Maybe you will make a treaty with the people who dwell in the land, and they will turn after their gods, and they will sacrifice to their gods, and they will call to you, and you will eat from their sacrifice." And then it says that you will intermarry. That's verse 16, okay? And then you will turn to their gods. So, as a matter of fact, Maimonides deduces from this, see, the word over here, vizavchu, means to slaughter. And they will slaughter to their gods, and they will call to you, and you will eat from their slaughter. So Maimonides says that's the basis for the law, that one is not permitted to eat from the an animal that was slaughtered by the Gentile, because of the fact that based upon this, you see, the Torah says that the Gentile's act of slaughter is not valid. Others say it has nothing to do with that. That the reason is because only a Jew is qualified to perform the slaughter. But at any rate, I just want to show from Maimonides one thing. That this verse where it says that you'll eat together and then you'll intermarry is an important one, because what the Torah is saying here is, and this is something again which psychoanalysts have shown quite recently in this century, that eating together is a strong form of identification. You'll notice, for instance, that when people get together to do a business deal, they go out and eat, have lunch over it. Why? Because people like to identify with others whom they're doing business with. It's not just business. It really is an act of identification and friendship. So the Torah always recognized. That's why, for instance, one is not permitted, a Jew is not permitted to drink the wine of a Gentile. This has caused a lot of problems throughout the ages, because people who wanted to cause anti-Semitism would tell a particular king or someone who was extremely high position to say, you see, the Jews hate you. If you touch their wine, he's not going to drink it. So, then this would happen, and they would say, well, the Jew considers us an abomination because we touched his wine, and he won't drink it. But the truth of the matter is that, by the way, that halacha does not apply to a ben Noach. It applies only if a person who believes in idolatry touches the wine, then the wine is prohibited. A person who accepts the seven laws, his touching of the wine doesn't create any prohibition. But the reason is because of removal of identification from people who are idolaters. So you have to realize that God, in his divine wisdom, knew that the Jewish people, if they're going to be a holy nation, as it says in Exodus, a kingdom of priests and a holy nation, they will only be able to maintain that if they don't identify with the neighboring primitive idolatrous groups. Now, one of the ways of identification, one of the strongest ways, is eating together. So therefore, this kashrus, keeping kosher, was the third principle in keeping kosher, was to keep the nation, to make sure that the nation remains true to the ideals of Torah, and is not diluted through identification with the other nations, the other groups, in which case they would intermarry, and then their sanctity and their uniqueness as guardians of the Torah would be immediately lost. So it turns out that there are really three reasons for kashrus. One is on a personal level, to raise a person to the higher sphere. Recognition of the faculty of the mind, and that we should be guided by our intellect, by our mind, our knowledge. And the second thing is, as we mentioned last week, is to avoid primitive activities. And the third one really is to maintain the nation of Israel. Now, which is actually all the laws, all the 613, by the way, in my opinion, this is my theory, which is that The difference between the Ben Noach and the Ben Israel is precisely this, that insofar as individual perfection is concerned, they are both equal, in my opinion. They both can partake of the Torah's mitzvahs to perfect themselves. The Ben Israel has no choice. He must keep all 613. In my opinion, it is because of the fact that there's two obligations to Torah. One is personal gain, and the second is the maintenance of the system of Torah through the nationhood of Israel. So I believe the reason why the Jew is obligated, and it's not optional, is because he has that responsibility to keep the nation. That's why he can't pick and choose any mitzvahs, because then the whole system will fall apart. But the Ben Noach doesn't have that obligation as a nation, so for him it's just a question of the personal. The personal is optional. He has the right to, he can do it if he wants to. It's wonderful. If he doesn't want to, he's not obligated. He doesn't have the obligation to guard the Torah throughout the ages. He can benefit and partake of it on an individual basis just as much as the Ben Israel. Now, I believe that theory is a correct one and holds out. Now I'd like to return to what I began to talk about, and that is the concept of taboo. And I mentioned that it's extremely important that we understand that there is no such thing as taboo in Torah. As a matter of fact, if a person starts reducing Torah to taboo ideas, then they are really doing the opposite of what the Torah is trying to do. If Torah is trying to raise a person to a higher level, away from these primitive emotions, and he's going back to the primitive emotions. And you know, the prophet states that the wicked, the Torah, the way of the Torah is that the righteous walk in it and the wicked stumble in it. And that means to say that even the words of the Torah, if done improperly, it can be a stumbling block. You use it in the wrong way. You have to study the Torah and gain knowledge before you use it in the proper way. Now, I show that it's not taboo from the Torah itself, because the Torah has as one of the commandments to differentiate and to teach. In Leviticus it says to differentiate between the clean and the unclean, and to teach, instruct the people of Israel. Where you see it's instruction and differentiation and learning and knowledge. That's the positive aspect. Now, my theory, of course, my idea of kashrus is based on that principle. But, we always look for as much corroboration as we can in order to establish what we're saying is true. And the place that we go for corroboration is always the oral law. If we hit it right, the oral law will support it. If we don't, if it's not supported by the oral law, then we've made a big mistake. I would like to bring some further support for this concept from the oral law. One could wonder, it doesn't seem proper that you get a certain sense of propriety, that perhaps it's not proper to eat a pig. It's just not a proper thing. But I want to show you that that isn't true. The Torah says in Deuteronomy, it says Deuteronomy 6, okay? It says, by the way, the build-up to kashrus in Deuteronomy is all about idolatry. I mean, the idea of kosher is introduced, for instance, the concept of in Deuteronomy 12, if you take a look, it says when you want to eat flesh, so then and you slaughter the animals, you shouldn't right. So eventually, he says you shouldn't drink the blood. You see, because blood is also an idolatrous thing, because they believe a special power in the blood. That's why it says that you shouldn't eat the flesh with the life. Of course, the life is in the blood. Now, we know that that's true today. It was, of course, since the time of creation, that in the human body, the heart, as important as it is merely a pump. What keeps a person alive is the blood. All the blood is what brings the nutrients to the cells, what brings oxygen and takes away the impurities from the cells. The blood is really is the lifeline. And primitive people always thought that if you drink the blood, it's going to have special powers. That's why it says the Torah makes a strong emphasis on that. It says in Deuteronomy 12:23, "But make only strengthen yourself, not to eat the blood, because And Rashi says that the first interpretation that Rashi gives, which is that they were, that people were involved, deeply involved in drinking blood. And that's why the Torah says strengthen yourself, because it was something they had to pull themselves away from. Why do, it's nothing so tasty about blood. But obviously the reason why they were involved in it was because of the primitive. And that's why the Torah says strengthen yourself and get away from that primitive idea and refrain from drinking blood. So it's all a build up to the, to kashrus, which is based upon a removal, as we mentioned, from the primitive and the idolatrous. But and that's why when we say that the whole Torah is against idolatry, it means that there, if you look through most of the mitzvahs, you will always find how that the Torah is trying to remove man from the primitive. Now returning to this point that I just started before, sorry for that little digression, but take a look at Deuteronomy 6, 11. 10 and 11, actually. So it says, when God will bring you to the land which he swore to your fathers, to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob, to give it to you, so you'll see gigantic cities and good cities that you didn't build. And then it states, and houses that are filled with all that is good, which you didn't fill. All right? Now, the rabbis say on this, what does it mean when it says houses that are filled with all that which is good? The rabbis say it means the pig that were dehydrated or pickled in jars or that were these delectables, these delicious foods, and that is what the Torah is speaking about. And the Torah is saying that, if you take a look at the end of the verse, it says, and you will eat and you will be satisfied. So, according to Nachmanides' interpretation, this basically means that the time when the Jewish people capture the land, they are allowed, at the time of conquest, to eat pig and to eat any non-kosher food at that time. Which I want to show you that you'd imagine that, well, you can't imagine a person eating pig. Even a great scholar would be permitted to eat pig at that time. So, again, to show you that the Torah is not a taboo system. That's one thing I want to show you from the oral interpretation. The second thing I wanted to tell you was that actually a Jew, according to halacha, can eat something which is not kosher. And you'll say to me, well, but how is that possible? I'll tell you how it's possible. Because we have a system of nullification. As a matter of fact, Doug asked me a question last year. Doug Taylor, yes. He asked me a question last year. He said, as we were driving in the car, he said to me, Rabbi, he says, how could you avoid eating something that's not kosher? Because anything you take tuna fish, for instance, we know that there are little amounts of, small amounts of bugs and things that fall into the product as is being produced, especially today, mass-produced. So how could you eat anything, basically? Everything has some kind of non-kosher contaminants in it, to some degree. So I told him, I said, that the oral system already dealt with this problem and that we have a nullification of a ratio of 60 to 1. So if you have something, if you have a 60 to 1 ratio of kosher to non-kosher, it's kosher. All right, so a person can't consume a 1/60th of non-kosher, but it even goes further than that. This system also states that, let's say, for instance, you have two pieces of kosher meat and one piece of non-kosher meat on the table, and they get mixed up. Then, according to the basic law, and I'm just saying, according to the basic law of the Torah, there is no question you can eat all three. Okay? Eat all three. So, you see that, so there you can see how a person, and this is the greatest scholar. If somebody would simply refuse to do it, it would be considered apostasy, because he's basically saying that the Torah is, that the Torah is saying that something's permissible when it's not. And he would not be considered an observant Jew. So this is not something that's an optional thing. It's 100% permissible. Therefore, I can show you that the most observant Jew is permitted to eat non-kosher food under certain circumstances. And if we would say that this non-kosher food, it would even be with regard to ham. The only thing is you could taste it. If it tastes differently, then you could identify it, then you can't use this. This can only be used where it's unidentifiable. But, for instance, if you have kosher meat and non-kosher meat, or you can't taste the difference between the horse meat or the beef or whatever, but I've never tasted pig, but I understand it has a different kind of a taste. But that's irrelevant. The point is, non-kosher food can be eaten under certain circumstances where you have, as I gave the case I gave you, have three pieces of meat, one is non-kosher, two are kosher. We say we go by majority, you can eat the whole thing. Now, there again, you see, there is no such thing as taboo. The third thing I wanted to introduce to you was a piece of Talmud in the Tractate of Chulin, which deals with kosher and non-kosher. And the Talmud tells us a little story. The Talmud tells us that, one second, let me just find it. Okay. That the Talmud tells us that Yalta, her name, it was the name of a woman, Rav Nachman was a great scholar, great Talmudic scholar, and his wife's name was Yalta. And Yalta asked her husband a question. This is what she said. She said, let us take a look. She says, everything that the Torah prohibited to us, it also made it permissible. Okay? For instance, blood is prohibited, but then liver is really soaked with blood, and that's permissible to eat. Okay? Now she says, again, we have the laws of the menses, where two people are prohibited to cohabitate when a woman is seeing menstrual blood. Okay? But then again, if we take a look in Leviticus, we see that after a birth, there's the 33 days for the male and 66 days for the female. In other words, if a woman gives birth to a female child, so after there are 66 days in which any blood that she sees does not count as menstrual blood, and it's perfectly permissible. So it's the same exact blood, but under those conditions it's permissible, and under other conditions it's not permissible. So she says, so we see again this principle that what the Torah prohibits, it also, the very same thing, it makes permissible. Then let's take the fat. You're not allowed to eat the fat of an animal, but you could eat the fat of a wild animal, like a deer. Okay? Then she says, this one I didn't do any research on, maybe somebody wants to do it because I'm curious about this. She says the pig is prohibited, but then there's some kind of a fish, I don't know exactly what it is, which tastes exactly like pig, and that's permissible. Okay? Now, I don't know what that particular fish is, but she says that you're not permitted to live with another man's wife, yet a divorcee is permissible. And she gave another case where the wife of a brother is prohibited, but then there is the law of Yibum, in which case where the brother dies without children, that the surviving brother marries the deceased brother's wife. And then she said, you're not permitted to live with a Gentile, but in the time of war, one is permitted to live with the when there's a whole chapter in Deuteronomy, as you know, where in time of war, one is permitted to take a Gentile, and then they have the Jew and Gentile live together. Then so she says, what I want to do is I want to eat meat and milk together. Okay, now where is the case that I want to eat it? And show me a case where it's permissible. So her husband said, you take the udders and you cook them with the milk in them. And according to Tosfos, you have to make a cut, a basic cut, but there still will be plenty of milk left in there. And when you cook the udders in the milk, that's permissible, because that's not regular milk, because it wasn't milked out of the udders. So that's the case where you see that even milk and meat, which is prohibited, is again permissible under certain circumstances. Now, the reason why I brought this Gemara is not to go into all these cases, but I wanted to show you that this was something which was accepted knowledge in the time of the Talmud, that whatever the Torah prohibited is also permissible. Why? The reason is to show man precisely that there is no taboo about any of the kashrus laws of the Torah. Okay? And that God wants man to differentiate, to exercise his intellect, to determine before he satisfies his urges, make a determination. Is it, should I do it or should I not do it? I have to consult the halacha. I must consult a body of knowledge before I make my decision. But not that anything is simply no good, prohibited, and even the greatest scholar, as I said, can under certain circumstances. Moses would be permitted to eat pork. Joshua, when he conquered the seven nations, he's permitted to eat pork as they entered the land. And these jars of pork that were there that they found in the homes were perfectly permissible, and there was no problem with eating it. And if a person says he's not going to eat it because he wants to be ultra-religious, what he's doing is he's adding to the Torah, which is one of the worst violations, as you know, as it states openly in the Torah. A person not allowed to add or subtract. You can't, this is not our religion. God is the one that dictates this religion. So the moment we start dictating our own ideas, then we're in trouble, and then basically there's one principle in Torah, and that is anything that you dictate is basically an idolatrous primitive idea. The Torah teaches man to subordinate himself to God's knowledge and God's system, and to rid himself of his own primitive emotions. So, as I said, we find very strong corroboration. I would say, it's 100% corroboration from the oral system. And the oral law is, as you know, I mean, the basis, without the oral law, the Bible itself is simply of no value whatsoever. We can't understand a word of it. That's why people who have rejected the oral law have gone away from all the commandments, because they can't make any sense out of it. And in the case of Kashrus alone, it states that you shouldn't touch the body of a dead animal. That's in Deuteronomy 14:8. So that would mean if a horse died in the middle of the street, we can't get rid of it. We have to leave it, let it rot in the street, which is obviously ridiculous. Or how can you play with a football that's made out of pigskin, which is a carcass of a dead animal? But obviously, the oral interpretation shows that that's nonsensical, and that what the Torah means is not that you can't touch the body of a dead animal. It means that if you make contact with it, you can't enter into the temple. It has to do with a different system of law. And in the case of the football, when something is made into a vessel, a utensil, and it's not considered the body of the animal anymore halachically. But these are halachic areas. But I just want to emphasize and reemphasize the fact that without the oral interpretation, we have basically nothing. We don't understand a thing about Torah. And people who have rejected the oral interpretation of the scholars reject all of mitzvahs, because all the commandments, because you can't possibly understand them. They don't make any sense if you take them in a literal way. So again, that we are amply corroborated from the oral law that the system of keeping kosher, there's nothing inferior about the pig, and there is no value in abstaining from it. God doesn't consider it a horrible thing. He allowed the people of Israel to eat it when they entered the land. He allows you to eat the most religious, observant Jew is permitted to eat non-kosher under certain circumstances. And this is clear from the oral law. Okay, that's basically, I think, what I wish to say insofar as the kosher is concerned. Now, there's one thing I wanted to show you. I wanted to show the... can you give me an Isaiah? I would like to show you something from Isaiah, which I think explains very nicely... Hebrew. explains very nicely the two concepts that we mentioned. In the end of Isaiah, it mentions about the people who eat the pig, see? Now, take a look at that. Excuse me. Just give me 1 minute. Okay. Here it is. It's Isaiah 66:17. Okay, now it says, the ones who eat the pig and that which is disgusting and the mouse, they will both together be consumed, saith the Lord. Okay? That's you got that 66:17. Now take a look at that verse. Now why does he say the pig, and then he mentions the abominable, the sheketz, means that which is disgusting, and he mentions the mouse? The reason is because here he's giving the two reasons for kashrus. And the two reasons for kashrus is the pig a person eats because he can't control his instincts. He doesn't differentiate. And the disgusting things is because he's attracted to primitive rites and primitive emotions. That's why he says they will be consumed. Because here in this example, he is showing you Rabbi?
Him.
Yes.
We got to change the tape.
Okay. Basically, that's my point. The point I was making was that Isaiah is pointing to two classes of violations of kashrus. One is the pig, in which a person violates because of his desire, and the other one is the disgusting in the mouse, which was Maimonides mentioned, that they would sacrifice mice and eat mice, and that's the primitive activity. And that's why Isaiah mentions both. Okay, that's my point.
Rabbi.
Yes.
Isn't it permissible if you were starving to death to eat the pig and the mouse or whatever it took to keep you alive?
Oh yeah. Well, that's a general principle of Torah. That except for three violations, a person is obligated to maintain his life and to violate the Torah law. That's correct. That's 100% correct. But what I wish to demonstrate was even beyond that, even where it's not a matter of life and death, one is permitted to eat non-kosher under certain circumstances, namely the two circumstances that I mentioned, the nullification circumstance and also the circumstance of entering the land when they conquered the land. And as a matter of fact, I wanted to point out one more thing. You'll see it says, houses that are filled with all that is good. And look at that adjective, all that is good. And the rabbis say that is referring to the pig, to pork. Now, so you see the Torah calls pork good. Now that is an amazing concept. Where you see the Torah is telling you, this is wonderful, it's delicious, it's very good. There's nothing wrong with it. The only thing is that God wants the people to make decisions concerning their instincts based upon the higher sphere, the sphere of knowledge and differentiation and halacha. He wants them to raise themselves to a higher level. Not because the pig is bad. Pig is good. It's delicious. Wonderful. Matter of fact, I used to camp, and I was in the home of a very good friend of mine who was a non-Jew, and he was making pork one day, and I went over and I smelled the pot. I said, "It smells delicious." So he looked at me, you know, like he was surprised, like he thought I would consider it to be a terrible thing. No, I said, "It smells delicious. It's great. I wish I could have some, but I can't do it. The Torah doesn't permit me to do it." But the Torah system is an anti-taboo system, as the story of Yalta, the wife of Rabbi Nachman, clearly expresses. Okay,
Rabbi, in Deuteronomy chapter 12, okay. It's talking about before they go into the land. Mm-hmm. In verse 15,
yep.
It's talking about, notwithstanding, you may kill and eat flesh in all your gates, whatsoever your soul desires, according to the blessings of the Lord your God,
great.
which he has given you, the unclean and the clean may... you may eat thereof as of the gazelle and as of the hart. Is that the example Yeshua was given a while ago?
No, I didn't mention this one. No, over there, unclean does not mean unclean, an unclean animal. Over there, it means unclean there's a system of, see, the word unclean has two different meanings. One is a certain species of animal, and the other meaning is certain, if you make contact, you cannot go into the temple with it. Over here, it means that's what it means by unclean. Over here, something that you can eat in your own privacy. You can eat something which is unclean. It means it made contact with something which is unclean, but not that it's a non-kosher animal. Okay, so that word is used in two different ways. All right, in the Torah, you have that same word used in two different ways. By the way, there's something which I wanted to mention to you, and that is that the Torah was very careful in the animals that it chose. And the kosher animals that it chose are mainly animals that... Hello? Yes,
Rabbi.
Yeah.
Is not the gazelle there the unclean animal of the two?
No. No, that's not... No. Does not mean that. No. It means the gazelle is not unclean. The gazelle is clean. You're allowed to eat a gazelle. It's kosher, because it chews the cud and it has split hoofs. Okay? It says... What it means over there... it says... excuse me. Let me get this. Let me just interpret this verse for you, okay? It says, "Only with the desire of your heart you shall slaughter and eat flesh, as the blessing of the Lord your God, which He gave you in all your dwelling places." Now he states, "The clean and the unclean can eat it." Over here, it's referring to the man, the person, the person who is clean and unclean, which means a person who made contact with certain objects, which in Leviticus it states, if you make contact with these objects, you're unclean. For instance, a dead animal. Okay, you're unclean. And again, I said, even though the Torah says you should not make contact with it, it doesn't mean that you're not allowed to touch it. It means if you do touch it, you're not allowed to go into the temple. Okay, now over here it's stating, on the contrary, that when you're not in the temple area, even an unclean person is permitted to eat the flesh. He's permitted to eat flesh. Whereas, with regard to animals that are sacrificed in the temple, the unclean person is not permitted to eat it. In other words, a piece of meat from a sacrifice, an unclean person is not permitted to eat. Whereas in your own dwelling place, an unclean person can eat the...
All right. Here's the point. We read in the Talmud, it talked about that a person that had eaten the hazael, the pig, would not have a part in the world to come.
Excuse me?
All right.
What is
it said that I can't recall who. There's one of our teachers told us that whoever one there was a piece in the Talmud. I think it was in. Excuse me. Well, okay. That if anyone there's one part in the Talmud, and they said it was a minority opinion that whoever ate of the pig would not have a part in the world to come.
No such thing. I can assure you there's no such thing.
No such thing.
No such thing. And I'll tell you something else. According to him, when the Torah says when they enter the land and they find these goodies, which are pig, I mean, that would mean if they ate that, they're not going to have a place in the world to come. Now, how can the Torah advise people not to have a place in the world to come? It's nonsensical. There's no such thing. I don't know who said it, but it does not exist. I wanted to mention another thing. You'll notice the animals that the Torah specified as kosher. They are mainly animals which are easily found among civilized people, you know, the sheep and the goats and the chickens, things which are basically domesticated animals, okay, and a few wild animals, but there are no exotic animals like lions, tigers, or even the birds that the Torah specifies as kosher. They are not exotic birds. They're not wild. The main sign among the birds, the Torah doesn't mention the sign, but the oral tradition says that the main characteristic is that the bird is not rapacious. In other words, it's not a bird of prey. Birds of prey are the ones that are basically prohibited. And the reason, I believe, is because the primitive people, if you ever read about their ways of life, they would always believe that if you eat these exotic animals, that they have certain powers, and that when you consume their flesh, I mean, even to this day, there are animals that are being destroyed by people in the world because they believe that when they eat them, they gain certain powers. Like they would kill the rhinoceros for its tusk to make it into a powder. It has certain kind of powers. And this exists even in the world in the present day situation. The Torah prohibited all these things because the Torah wanted to keep man away from that. The animals that we eat are very common. There's nothing special about them. Interesting enough is that the animals that are sacrificed are even more limited. Because over there we don't sacrifice even wild animals like a deer or anything like that. Purely domesticated animals. There are only five species that are permitted. Two of them are the birds, which are the doves and the pigeons, which are common. And the other three species are common animals: the goats and the sheep, and then the oxen. The larger animals, and that's it. So you see, when it comes to the sacrifice over there, God did not wish that we sacrifice even a wild animal like a deer, which people feel has, it runs quickly, it has certain qualities. On the contrary, the sacrifice was the most simple, common animal where you can't attach any kind of wild imagination to. And in my opinion, that's why Noah, when he sacrificed, was only permitted to sacrifice the animals that the Torah permits to be given before God as a sacrifice. Because even though there was no law at the time, but the concept of not sacrificing before God some animal that's exotic and might be construed as having some kind of mystical powers, was even in that time was something which God wanted man to be removed from. So Noah and his family and those who observed him in the future, who followed him, would not do such an action where they would get involved in this primitive kind of form of sacrifice. I think that's another important point to observe, and that's again in line with the whole philosophy of the Torah, as the Talmud teaches us, and is manifest in the Torah itself. Once once the oral law puts its finger on something, you see it flows straight through the Torah. That the purpose of the Torah is to raise man to a higher level and to remove him from the primitive. There's nothing in the Torah that has any taint of primitivism. On the contrary, it's to remove man totally. And the animals that we use are plain, common animals, nothing exotic and nothing that fires the imagination, so to speak. Okay, any other questions, or should I go on?
No, I think I've got several if no one else has. And these people here have heard a lot of the arguments, some of the statements I'm about to make, and you have too. And I'm not asking for you to drop the party line at this point, meaning, you know, the things that you've been taught and the things you've shared with us. But here are two observations I want to make. Number one, that my study of history and religion, that any Gentile group, and I'll use a non-Jewish group, that has based their system upon the Bible, have always embraced some type of laws of kashrut. Secondly...
Excuse me again, I'm sorry.
All right, I said that all religious groups that base their system on the... And I should say the Hebrew scriptures more than the New Testament. But they go back to the New Testament as the or the Old Testament or the Hebrew Scriptures as a foundation. They have some type of law of kashrut, one, and then two, they have some form of Sabbath observance.
Okay.
All right. Now the point that I make, and
kashrut does the Christian have?
Yes. See, there are a number of Christian groups that keep a Torah kosher. And some, like,
I would really like to know how they do it, because again, you have problems if you. I think I did see an article on that, but I'd like to understand if they really believe that they're taking these verses literally without any interpretation. I would like to see what they do with the verse where it says you should not touch their carcasses, if in fact they do that too, and what exactly that means. I mean, they'd have a hard time explaining these things if they want to be consistent and just to take the literal meaning.
All right, for instance, like we have down here in Collegedale, the Seventh-day Adventists, they are vegetarians, and they have the McKee Bakery, and, they do all the stuff according to the numbers.
Yeah, but one second, where does it say in the Torah to be a vegetarian? I don't see that.
All right, well, it doesn't, but I said they have taken it, and I said one form or another.
Oh, I get you. Okay, I'm sorry about that.
One form or another. Now, the point that I have made and have for at least the last four or five years, that when you look in there, in the Torah, and I was going to give a lot of verses, and I won't do that, but if you go back with Noah, beginning with Noah, is the first time we have any identification of clean and unclean. And yet, they're not identified. And the Torah said that, and right in the text there of chapter 8, and Noah brings all the clean and unclean animals aboard, and it says that Noah was righteous, he was a tzaddik in his generation.
That's right.
And that he did all that God had commanded him to do.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it is obvious that there is more that God commanded him to do than is recorded in the text.
It could be, but... And I know you mentioned that this week.
Yeah.
The only thing is that it could be that, you know, I'm sure that God commanded him more than we have in the text. And that's common in Torah, that you see it from the Torah itself, that many times the text is very short and there's much more there. That's really where the oral law fills in a lot. But it could be that what he meant, everything he commanded him, could have been vis-a-vis the flood itself and vis-a-vis the ark. I mean, it's not clear that means because the context of that phrase, of that particular verse, is in the context of the flood.
Okay, but let's make this observation. That we talked about in Abraham, that Abraham fully observed my ordinance, statutes, commandments, and we've done that one.
Yes, we've done that one. Now I want you to know, though, that there's an argument among the scholars whether that means, as you said, and your interpretation is a valid one. I'm not questioning it. Some do interpret it that way. It means all the laws of the Torah. Others interpret it to mean the seven laws of Noah, which, as you know, are more than just seven laws. And with God's help, if we can start to study it, we'll see that there's a lot more than the seven laws, the six negative and the one positive. But, for instance, you had the concept of swearing, which existed in the time of, you see, Abraham made Eliezer swear. Now, swearing is a whole institution in the Torah. That itself is a whole tractate. As a matter of fact, we just studied that this year, and we hardly, dented the tractate. There's a lot to study when it comes to swearing, what a swear is, and et cetera, et cetera. Pharaoh, you see, in Joseph, Joseph told Pharaoh he swore. There's a lot more than just the seven laws, as you are familiar by now. And there's a lot more knowledge, too. So some want to say that when it says his ordinances and laws, it's referring to all the laws of the that a Ben Noach can abide by, which are hundreds. And and therefore that text has two interpretations. But I'm not making a choice between either interpretation. I accept yours as valid. And the point you're making is correct, that Abraham according to that interpretation, kept all the laws of the Torah, 613. But I'm trying to get to maybe I missed the main point over here.
Well, I haven't stated it yet. I'm kidding. The reason you haven't stated
it. My class,
not yours. right, your class. The point that I'm making is that we go through there, and you know better than I the examples that Abraham ate only kosher food. Then you go down to Isaac and Jacob, and then you have the story of the of how they were very careful to keep the eat only clean animals.
Well, it doesn't really state that anywhere openly in the Torah.
No, but again, we had a lesson. Where was it that you gave the lesson on, or someone gave the lesson on Ishmael? Not Ishmael. Who was it? It was with the God. My brain dead today. I don't even need to be doing this. When the blessing came, that had the kill the kid, put the hair on there. Yeah, Jacob. All right, Esau. All right, Jake. All right, there we go. See, everybody knew but me. And that how Jacob went out and killed the clean animal and brought it in, and you know how Esau would not have slaughtered it properly, et cetera, et cetera. Was that not? Did you not give us that class?
I did not give that class.
All right, who gave it?
I didn't give that class. And that is according to the view that maintains that the patriarchs only ate kosher. And they kept all the laws of the Torah, which I said I'm not denying that view, and it's a very valid view. Maimonides does not happen to accept that view, but there is no proof in the Torah itself, in the text itself, to support that view that it's correct. Even Nachmanides, who does accept it, he doesn't say he agrees that the Torah itself does not state that openly. But I would accept it. I mean, I'm not making a choice between the two views, The point that I would say is that if we do say, in fact, that Abraham kept the laws, as one view maintains, again I say he did not keep the law because of any kind of taboo system, but because of the fact that the law perfects man, raises him to a higher level, and that's the reason why he kept it, and also because he was the progenitor of the people, and the people have to identify with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and they can't identify. It would be improper. They wouldn't have a complete identification if they felt that he ate something which is not kosher, which they don't eat. So that would be the purpose of it.
All right.
But not because there is anything wrong. The point I'm trying to make is that there's no
way
the Torah defines anything wrong with a pig. As a matter of fact, the Torah calls pig a good thing.
All right. Would you Would you be prepared to say that the righteous people prior to Sinai, the revelation at Sinai, only ate clean, or would you say they ate clean and unclean both?
Before Sinai, I say that's the argument that we just discussed before.
All right. But would they do it? Would a Zadik eat unclean animals?
According to Maimonides, yes.
He would. All right. Do you have any examples of that in the Torah?
I can't cite any examples. The Torah does not have too many cases of people eating. I mean, there's only a limited number of cases. You have the case by Jacob and Isaac. And,
can y'all hear him?
You have the case by Jacob and Isaac, then you
no.
You don't have too many cases there. That's, you know, there's not enough in the Torah itself to draw any conclusion from it. Okay? But I could tell you this much. The Talmud states that they had incestuous relationships before the Torah, so that's why they cried, as a matter of fact. It says they cried to their families, and the Talmud says because they cried because they had to give up their incestuous relationships. So to my mind, if you could say they had incestuous relationships before, then I don't see why you can't say that they ate non-kosher. I mean, even according to the rabbis, it's only the patriarchs themselves that that didn't eat the non-kosher, but not the general population. So that's clear. I don't think anyone maintains that the general population in Egypt refrained from eating non-kosher food. I don't think any of you like that. So, and as I said, they gave up, you know, they were crying because they gave up the incestuous relationships. And certainly if they had incestuous relationships, then they certainly could eat non-kosher. So, again, I do not believe, and I would say this, that for the Ben Noach, if he wants to keep kosher, it's wonderful because a Ben Noach can keep any positive commandment in the Torah, and that is a positive commandment. But he must do it with a proper understanding that it perfects man, because it causes man to differentiate before he partakes, before he indulges in his instinctual desires, and not because there's anything magical or unclean about the animal itself. There's no difference between a horse and a cow. I mean, they're both God's creation. And if you think that there's something disgusting about a pig, grasshoppers are kosher too. I mean, frankly, I don't find the grasshoppers too appealing. Now, let's see, we have about 5 minutes left, if I'm not mistaken. What I'd like to take up is the question that was raised last week about the Ben Noach and work according to Rashi's view. And I said I would give it some thought, and Torah requires thought. It's intricate and it's deep, and I did give it some thought this week, and I would like to present you with what I've come up with. If you remember, there was a rebellion in the Torah. The first rebellion is the rebellion of Korach, and he rebelled against Moses and Aaron, as you recall, because he was upset that he could not have the priesthood. And that he made claims that Moses and Aaron took everything for themselves, and he was really an egalitarian. I mean, he was maintaining this is not fair, it's not democratic, and that everyone should be able to bring sacrifices. And as you know, the 250 men brought the incense, and they died. Now you have to understand again the oral interpretation. It gives us a little more insight into this story, because it's a difficult story to understand. How could this man rebel against Moses when the Torah just said before that everybody saw at Sinai that God trusts Moses implicitly with the law? And he can't just rise and get people to follow him in some crazy kind of rebellion. But the Talmud explains that what Korach did was he went before Moses and he stated as follows. He said, "I have a question. We know that a house has to have a mezuzah on it, okay? This is in front of the door. It's the most basic, simple halacha. Now, he says, what's the purpose of the mezuzah? The purpose of the mezuzah, obviously, is, if you take a look at the scroll, it has the central ideas of the entire Torah. God is one, love God, study Torah, keep the commandments. That's what's written inside that scroll on the door. So that when a person enters the house and leaves his house, he reminds himself of the metaphysical part of man, the real purpose of man's existence. You go outside to do your business, you forget about it for a moment, but then when you come back, you remind yourself, this is really the purpose of life. So Korach asked Moses, he said, well, let's say you have a house that's entirely filled with holy scrolls, the five books of Moses. It's entirely filled with Torahs. Would you say that I have to have this mezuzah outside the door to remind me? I'm going to walk into the room and I'm going to see 50 holy Torahs there. So why do I need this mezuzah on the doorpost? Okay? Then he said, you recall that the Torah says that there was a blue thread on the tzitzit, which we don't have that the color dye anymore, so we don't have that. But the Torah says that when you see it, you'll recall, you'll remember the, all the commandments of God. And the Talmud explains it's because the blue reminds one of the ocean, and the ocean reminds man of the heavens, which reminds man of the infinite, and then he thinks of God. So through that progression, man thinks of God, and then he thinks of his commandments. So he said, well, let's say the entire garment is blue. So why do you need the fringes? The blue and the garment will remind you of the oceanic experience, the heavens, the infinity, and then you'll think of God. So Moses said, no, you have to put on the, you must have that mezuzah in front of the door. I don't care how many Sefer Torahs you have in the house, and you must have that blue, you must have the fringes. So he began to laugh, the Talmud explains. And the Talmud has really explained to us what his argument was. That was the same argument with the priesthood. His argument was, basically, that God wants the commandments, but the commandments have philosophical relevance. He wants you to understand the philosophy behind the commandment. He doesn't care about the details of the commandment. He doesn't care. You don't have to put that mezuzah on the door. He wants you to remember the ideas. So Korach says, well, you know, if your house is empty, so that's a good idea to keep that mezuzah on the outside. Before you walk in, you'll see it, and you remind yourself. But when you have Sefer Torahs in the house, you don't need that mezuzah anymore. God does not care about halacha detail. God just wants you to know the ideas. Therefore, he says it doesn't matter that this priest he comes from the tribe of Levi, and he's a descendant of Aaron, that he should be a priest. God really wants anyone could be a priest, as long as he's a fine, good person. So laws, these specifics that you Moses are giving, we don't believe in them. We believe in the philosophy and the ideas of Torah, but not in the halacha. And Moses said to him, that's why Moses says, in the morning you shall find out. And Rashi comments over there, he says, this is like a law in nature, that God said that this is fixed. Just like you can't change the morning, you can't change the morning to afternoon, that's a law in nature. A law in nature is that law in Torah, a fixed law is that you must do the mitzvot exactly the way God says. If he said a mezuzah, you cannot devise your own method, even though your own method may for you even be more philosophically appropriate. But you must keep the halachic system. And that was the whole debate that they were having. That was the rebellion, really, of Korach against Moses. And the final outcome, as you know, was that God demonstrated through Moses and through an event that occurred that the...
We got
God,
1 minute.
1 minute left? Oh. Well, I'm afraid I won't be able to get to the answer, but we'll continue next week. But the point is that the rebellion of Korach taught the people of Israel that God, in fact, is concerned with halachic detail and not just the philosophy of Torah, but that if the law is that there must be fringes, I don't care if that garment is blue and reminds you of the ocean. It must be specifically through the method that God devised. This is a law that the Torah, once it's a law, it's fixed. Same thing with the priesthood. Even the greatest scholar, Rabbi Soloveitchik, was a Levi. He could be the greatest scholar, but he can't be the high priest because he does not descend from the tribe, from Aaron. And he's not a descendant of Aaron. Therefore, the law is fixed. And you cannot do it. You cannot change this. This is the way God has devised it. We subordinate ourselves to His system, and that is really what the final outcome of the Korach incident taught, or I shouldn't say it taught because that was taught before as well. But it fixed this concept of halacha. Now that's my introduction to the answer with regard to the Bnei Noach, which I will continue with, please God, next week. So have a good evening, and we'll talk to you next week.
Okay, well, everybody.